This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, January 10th, 2025, right? We will be discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Eve Zukoff and Jeanette Barnes. We'll speak with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. And we'll speak with Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. A new storm-deployable flood barrier has come to Provincetown, and with it hopes to save homes in the town's east end from inundation for a third winter in a row. CAI's Eve Zukoff checked out this new flood barrier and other prevention measures the town is taking. She joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
So this flood barrier, it's made of bright red plastic, almost like something from a preschool play yard. You saw it its first day out of the box. Nobody was quite sure what to make of it, it seems like. Tell us how it works.
Yeah, Steve, we can get it for you as like part of a jungle gym if you'd like.
It looks like that.
It does. It really does, actually. And it starts with 50 individual pieces. Each one is like 3 feet high, 3 feet wide. Again, bright red plastic, and they're like puzzle pieces. And it's up to the Department of Public Works. I watched this, a team of about six guys who need just about a half an hour to interlock all of them. And then when they do that, they're able to form this 150-foot wide watertight wall. They weigh that down with heavy sandbags. And when the stormwater comes, the water itself actually is part of what weighs this down, keeps these from being, you know, flying projectiles in the wind. And the idea is to really keep stormwater away from a couple dozen homes and businesses in Provincetown's East End because they have flooded for the last two winters in a row.
So you were there watching this get set up. You also spoke with someone who lives right there as this was happening, who's experienced flooding in the East End personally. Tell us his story.
Yeah, I talked to Quinn Taylor. He's the owner of Cafe Heaven on Commercial Street. People may know it. His house is from 1850, and he tells me the story of December 2022. He's in his home. He's in his bedroom, and he looks out his bedroom window during a storm, and all of a sudden, he sees waist-deep water in his front yard, and he's like, oh my gosh, what is that? And then within 20 minutes, water is seeping up through his floorboards, and he says it destroyed everything. He had to replace his floors, his kitchen, an original fireplace to the home, and it was the first time his house had flooded since 1971, and that, he says, was from heavy rainfall, not seawater, which this was. And then after the 2022 flood, he said he spent almost $1 million and a lot of time on renovations, and then a year to the day later, almost, the flooding happened again in his home, and he had to replace the kitchen again.
So this red plastic barrier that was deployed is intended to protect homes like his in the East End. These plastic barriers aren't the only thing the town is invested in to protect this area from flooding or areas in town from flooding.
Yeah, no. And town residents recently approved at town meeting a $150,000 fund to buy a bunch of things to kind of talk about puzzle pieces here. You know, that's how they're kind of acting. So they were able to buy a quick fill sandbag machine so that people can get free sandbags during storms. They spent the money on deep cleaning of catch basins. They bought the red plastic barrier for $12,000. And then more of the money, you know, there's a lot left in that $150,000, should be spent buying different barriers, or if this red plastic barrier ends up working really well, more of that. Just anything to redirect stormwater. And for the longer term, the town is working on a coastal resilience plan that looks at, you know, what is this community going to look like in 2070 as far as sea level rise, as far as storm surge, erosion. It's an attempt to find practical solutions to climate change.
So the big question, did this flood barrier work to prevent flooding in the East End the day you went out to see it deployed?
It's kind of unknown. It ended up being a little bit more of a nothing burger, that storm. No major flooding impacts. But, you know, it's really important. It will have its day in the sun, most likely, if history is any, you know, indication. Because, like, experts from the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies, they told me that, you know, the East End has changed because starting in 2018, this major storm weakened this one dune, which prompted the beachfront homeowner in the East End, whose home was right behind it, to elevate their home, allowing water to pass underneath it. So without this dune, and then without this home, that opened up a major new, what they call stormwater pathway, for floodwaters to just come into the low-lying East End streets right behind it. And you only need a couple low-lying area, a couple new stormwater pathways by a low-lying area to make an invulnerable place suddenly vulnerable.
Let's talk about another story you covered this week. The International Fund for Animal Welfare, IFAW, reports that about 600 marine mammals stranded on Cape Cod in 2024. What exactly does that mean, marine mammals, and how does that number compare to past years?
Yeah, we're talking here dolphins, whales, porpoises, you know, the cute ones, the cuddly ones. 600 marine mammals in a year, that's more than twice the annual average. It's just kind of a staggering number. And of those cases, about 375 were stranded dolphins, which is more than six times the annual average. IFAW also saw nearly a dozen large whales stranded on the Cape in 2024.
You also reported that 2024 sea turtle stranding total, I'm suspecting this was also a big year for these strandings as well.
Yeah, there's kind of a trend here. 2024 marked the fourth busiest season on record for Cape Cod sea turtle strandings. In raw numbers, staff and volunteers with Mass Audubon Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary rescued about 800 stranded sea turtles from Cape Cod beaches last year. That's more than 130 than the prior year. So these folks, thank them next time you see them. They're working hard.
So a lot of animals come strandings all through 2024. Beyond the total numbers that we're talking about, there were kind of some noteworthy overlaps here for both turtles and dolphins as we talk about strandings.
Yes, a lot of big records. So in June, IFAW responded to the largest mass stranding of dolphins in U.S. history. That happened right in Wellfleet. Mass Audubon also experienced the third busiest day in the entire program's 45-year history. That was in December. 141 sea turtles were rescued in a single day. Plus, you know, there were other, like, these people, they're so intimately connected to the sea life that they're finding, and there were other little bits and bobs, like the stranding coordinator for Mass Audubon, sea turtle stranding coordinator, Eamon Caffrey, told me he saw the largest loggerhead sea turtle he had ever seen. They're usually 20 to 80 pounds. He had a 123-pound loggerhead come in alive.
What's going on? Why was it such a big stranding year for all these species?
A number of factors, but kind of the key one here is warming waters. Like, it's a consequence of climate change. So warming waters have brought more southern species of bait fish inshore. Dolphins have followed. So that kind of helps perhaps explain what happened with dolphins. And then for sea turtles, also warming waters have brought more of them up north into kind of Gulf of Maine territory, where they never used to go. And then when they try to turn around, go south, many of them are getting stuck in Cape Cod's hooked arm. So kind of, it's interesting. It's warming waters, same answer, but two different pathways for why we saw these high stranding numbers.
Okay, now because of the holidays, it's been 3 weeks since we did a live roundup on CAI, but the news didn't stop during that time. And one of the stories that you reported, which I think is important to touch on, is about findings in a new scientific paper that says North Atlantic right whales are living just a fraction as long as they could and should live. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks and some other institutions found that North Atlantic right whales' median age at death is only 22 years, and then a few of them reach 48. And then in contrast, this incredibly closely related species called the southern right whales, they have a median lifespan of 73 years, and some live past 130. So basically, to kind of summarize this, that is how long experts believe right whales should be living. They live until about 22. They should live till about 130. Really, the difference here between the two species is entanglements in fishing gear, boat collisions, climate change. Also important to note, like, the history of whaling locally kind of accounts for that. And the paper authors argue that there's a real consequence to a young population. There are no individuals to show these animals how to stay alive when conditions change. Like, you need those wise teachers. We know whales communicate. They're just like humans. Having some wisdom in the group is really important.
Also, in these past weeks, a number of whales have washed up dead on local beaches, and some others have been found entangled in local waters. Summarize some of what we've been seeing with the whales.
Yeah, a few days before Christmas and the first night of Hanukkah, researchers found two critically endangered right whales entangled off Nantucket, and then another one was seen off North Carolina, all in the space of a week. It was a lot. And two of them, both of the males of this three whale group, were likely to die from their injuries. The one off Nantucket had fishing lines wrapped around his head and neck. The one off North Carolina was wrapped in a way that he couldn't open his mouth to feed, so he will probably starve. This is awful stuff. And why we report on it, actually. We have also, around the same time, seen a slate of whale deaths in Massachusetts from different species now. We're talking humpbacks and minkes. So, in fact, five dead whales washed up between Weymouth and Wellfleet in under a month. Two of the whale deaths have been connected to boat collisions and infectious disease. The other three results are still pending.
This week, the president-elect was referencing the number of whale deaths on our shores, calling out Massachusetts in particular, and tying them to offshore wind, which prompted a lot of talk on social media. You've already done a lot of reporting on whether there is a connection between whale deaths and offshore wind. Tell us again, revisit some of this. What did you find when you looked at this?
Yeah, I mean, this week Trump said, quote, the windmills are driving the whales crazy, obviously. Now, I spent months in earnest trying to find out how offshore wind could, in present and future terms, hurt whales. I put everything I learned into a story we put out called The Complicated Truths About Offshore Wind and Right Whales. Really, we have no agenda here. I wanted to know if that was real or not. And the short version of the story, I'll sum it up as best I can, is basically that, yes, North Atlantic right whale scientists have worries that this species on the brink could be negatively affected by offshore wind development. But early research has started to dispel some of their worries, and that's what they wanted. They believe that there should be, like, a turbine built, we study what happens, another turbine built, we study what happens, that's kind of the way this needs to go. And their worries, again, about how whales could be impacted by noise, by ocean circulation, some of those concerns have started to be dispelled by early research. And in general, more than half a dozen scientists and conservation advocates I interviewed for this story agreed on this one point that was summarized by IFAW veterinarian Sarah Sharp really well. She said, we've got decades of data that says that these whales are dying from entanglements and vessel strikes. That means boat collisions. And we need to stay focused on those two main causes. And she ended this by saying, all of the discussion about wind farms right now, I feel like it's just really distracting from the real issues. That is like, that was the quote that summed up hours and hours and hours of research that I was doing about how scientists were feeling even beyond what the research currently shows.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to CAI's Jeanette Barnes about a new ship leaving port. And Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times, stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Tomorrow morning, Massachusetts Maritime Academy's new training ship, the Patriot State, is scheduled to depart from the school's dock shortly before 7 a.m. It will have 540 students on board for the annual sea term. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with that story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
You had a chance to visit the ship this week while the students were busy preparing for the trip. First, just tell us a little bit about what a sea term is.
Sure. Mass Maritime has a winter term in January and February. And during that time, students in certain majors go out on the training ship. Marine engineering and marine transportation majors go out on the ship for sea term three times as freshmen, sophomores, and seniors. In addition to that, there are students who do one sea term. Those are the facilities engineering majors. So they've got plenty of students on board. It can take up to 600 students, and they're learning to operate a huge seagoing vessel in various ways. So some of the drills will be on things like anchoring and maneuvering the ship. As you said, they're leaving tomorrow. Their first stop is off Mayagüez, Puerto Rico. It's a big anchoring area, I'm told, and they're going to be doing some anchoring there. From there, they will be stopping in San Juan, Puerto Rico. They'll go to Charleston, South Carolina. St. Thomas, Virgin Islands, and then up to Tampa, Florida, before heading home toward the end of February.
This is a big ship, up to 600 students, you said. What was happening when you visited this week? I understand they have a lot of supplies to bring on board, especially considering that many students and crew and staff.
Yes, they have a lot to do this week. It's kind of a big annual thing, loading the ship. They've been bringing on various equipment and supplies, especially seeing as it's the first sea term voyage for this ship. But when I visited on Tuesday, the big thing was the food. The ship has a loading area up on the second deck, and the students were bringing on pallets piled high with food that had been hoisted by a crane up to that level. They had five tractor trailer loads of food to unload. And the students do this thing in the hall where they make a human chain from the hallway where they've opened the pallets to bring case by case of food into the walk-in refrigerator so they can put it all away. And they're kind of passing the boxes from student to student all down into the fridge. There's a senior student there, Andrew Fusco, who is showing me around the ship. He is actually the training ship commander, which is the top student leader on board. And he said students do like to kind of make jokes and have some fun with unloading all that food because it does take a bit of time. And they were in good spirits in doing that when I was there.
Now, this ship replaces the previous training ship, the Kennedy, which was built in 1967. What did you see on board that's new and different in comparison to that old ship?
Oh, well, many, but one of the biggest differences that pertains directly to students' education is the training bridge. So it is a navigational bridge like you would have on a ship, but it has the same equipment as the main bridge, but it's on the deck below. So while the captain and the crew and a small number of students are upstairs on the main bridge, other students can be downstairs doing simulations on the same equipment. The ship is also powered differently. It's diesel to electric, whereas the old one was steam. And students said, of course, the digital instrumentation for that is new as well. So those are just a few of the many updates since 1967.
The federal government has commissioned this and other training ships in part because of the national interest in having a strong merchant marine. Tell us about how this mass maritime ship fits into that larger picture.
Sure. So it trains merchant mariners, right? People working on big seagoing vessels in private industry. And I talked with the president of Mass Maritime, Francis McDonald, about that. He says, of course, that's good for the economy because of shipping and all the things that, the goods that we send and receive by shipping. But also, civilian merchant mariners support the military around the world in all kinds of situations by carrying and supplying things like fuel, people, ammunition, supplies, and so on. So these students are future merchant mariners who may be doing things like that. And also, the Patriot State, this new vessel, is equipped to help with federal disaster response. So it can take on additional people and their vehicles on board and supplies and things for disaster aid.
Hey, let's talk for a minute about offshore wind. We know President-elect Trump has said he wants to stop any new offshore wind farms from being built, but Massachusetts is still moving forward with two wind farms that already have federal approval. Tell us what's coming up on this.
Sure. So the wind developers who were selected in last year's bidding have been negotiating their power purchase agreements, essentially contracts with the power companies like Eversource and National Grid. They're scheduled to sign those contracts next Wednesday. And those projects are New England Wind 1 and South Coast Wind. But of course, the timing is interesting. As you and Eve were talking about a minute ago, President-elect Trump has made some more comments this week about offshore wind. He's vowed to stop new wind farms. But these two projects in Massachusetts do already have their federal approval. So it'll be for them, hopefully, from their point of view, it'll be full steam ahead unless President Trump does something to stop that. But it's unclear right now if he will have his sights on these projects that are already approved.
Remind us a little bit about these particular two wind farms, where they're located and how they connect and everything like that.
Sure. Well, both are in the same general area as Vineyard Wind, down south of Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. New England Wind 1 is similar in size to Vineyard Wind, a little smaller, and it plans to land cables at Craigville Beach in Barnstable. Some residents have opposed that. South Coast Wind is a bit larger, over 1,200 megawatts, and it will be landing cables in a Brayton Point at Brayton Point in Somerset. I think it's safe to say the opposition to the wind farms has increased a bit since that broken blade incident in the summer, but still, offshore wind does have a lot of support in our area because, of course, of its role in reducing our carbon footprint and thereby fighting climate change.
We'll have to leave it there. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Insurance companies are increasingly backing out of offering homeowners insurance on Martha's Vineyard. The island has the third highest rate of non-renewal in the country, according to a new report. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times is here to explain what that means for homeowners and what it could signal for the local economy long term. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
So insurance rates keep going up. We know that. But this report suggests that fewer companies are willing to offer homeowner policies in our region. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a complex story. But right, as we've seen in evidence in Los Angeles right now, climate change, causing these bigger and stronger storms or, bigger wildfires across the country. And because they're dealing so much more damage, insurance companies are having to pay out more. Insurance companies, and I'm relying on some reporting from the New York Times and other outlets here, but they're abandoning areas that, they don't see as profitable or worried they're going to lose money there. But what we learned, this U.S. Senate Budget Committee released the findings of this report looking into this issue. And last year, they wanted to get a sense of how widespread and where insurance companies were abandoning areas more frequently. And the findings show that Martha's Vineyard or Deuce County is one of the highest non-renewal rates in the country. Cape Cod, Nantucket is in there as well, really high, essentially meaning that companies left the area at a higher rate than other areas. And it was kind of particularly bad in 2023. The study actually showed that basically one in every policies on the island were not renewed in 2023, which is pretty alarming.
So wait, say that one more time. One in every 10?
One in every 10 policies. Mm-hmm. That's my understanding of this study. But it doesn't really get into specifics on why. And there's been some reporting that tries to dispute that we can't be conclusive on what's going on. But the reality is that it comes down to climate, as from the folks that we talk to. And worth mentioning, we've talked to a lot of insurance agents on the island, and they say that rates for insurance are going up as much as 30% across the board as well at the same time. So while companies are abandoning these areas, it's getting harder to find coverage. It's also getting a lot more expensive.
Let's talk a little bit about what the sort of the follow-on impacts of this could mean. People need insurance to get a mortgage to buy a house.
Yeah. So on the federal level, they're warning of a recession from insurance company abandoning areas. As you were saying, right, if you can't get insurance, you're not going to be able to get a mortgage, or at least a lot of people won't. And without mortgages, the only people that will be able to buy homes are those with a lot of cash, which essentially means that housing costs could plummet if there isn't solution. Or they're essentially warning of a recession like 2008. It's pretty grim report. But we talked to some bankers, municipal workers, insurance agents on the island, and they're not in panic mode. They aren't seeing people, not being able to get mortgages at this point. I think in general, the Vineyard, trends towards wealthier landowners. We're not seeing kind of an economic collapse here, in other words. So I don't want to freak people out too much.
But it does add to the stress that people are under. It means that homeowners, right, even now, are scrambling. If you're talking about insurance rates going up by as much as 30%, that's a lot more for people to add into a budget that's already stretched pretty thin by inflation.
But for sure. And I do, right. One of the agents we spoke to is, the point he made on the national level, this isn't just the Vineyard. This is happening all over. And I think, his point, there are a lot of politicians that kind of question climate change, if it's actually real. And this report and the insurance market in general is providing proof. You know, the insurance market knows that it's real and it's reacting and it's causing some serious problems for families. I will say we had some difficulty kind of understanding why the vineyard is such an outlier, why kind of our region, but the answer we got makes the most sense to me. These insurance companies are basing their decisions on kind of complex modeling. They're not just making this up. And there's a worry on the island that will be eventually hit by a big hurricane. And with really expensive homes on the island, the insurance companies are worried about that expense. But the message we got from insurers is that this is really a problem countrywide. So the vineyard, you know, might be really high, but everyone else is dealing with this across the country.
And certainly Nantucket and Barnstable counties as well, as you say.
Yeah, Barnstable, I believe, for its size, was really up in the top five for non-renewal rates across the country, and Nantucket was not far behind from the vineyard. So it was just a surprising report to see locally this so high. When you think Florida is where they're having such insurance problems, in California with wildfires, but really, you know, we're seeing this locally.
Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Sam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Nauset Regional Middle School is getting some closer scrutiny after reported incidents of racial bullying. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with this story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Your reporter, Ryan Bray, took a detailed look at this from the parent and the student side and from the teaching and the administrative staff. Start by giving a sense of like the kinds of issues that we're talking about, what you heard from parents.
Sure. Ryan spent a long time looking at this story, and basically what he was hearing from some parents was that there was a number of incidents of bullying, racial bullying, cyberbullying at the Nauset Middle School, which parents and at least one faculty member said that the administration of the school and the district were either not taking seriously or were kind of ignoring. One specific incident involved racial bullying of a Black student who later attempted to take his own life. In this situation, there was an educator who had tried to warn the administration about this, and he alleges that Principal Peter Cohen didn't take the situation seriously, considered the student an inaccurate reporter, in quotes, because the student had some other issues. But Mr. Cohen denies that he downplayed this and said that the school acted appropriately in addressing the situation. There was another specific situation that Ryan dug into involving a student who was cyberbullied and subjected to ridicule at the school. And that was a little more complex situation because it involved both on and off campus issues. The school officials basically said, you know, that it's hard to, police student use of Instagram and things like that. And they can only do what they're able to do when the students are at the school. And in both these cases, there's been the students were taken out of the school. One of the students ended up in Provincetown. The other has since gone on to Nauset High School, where his parents said he's much happier and the culture there is much more inclusive.
There's a lot of detail in the story here about the incidents themselves, as reported by the parents, I guess, and also confirmed through the school where they could be. And then speaking to Principal Cohen and the Superintendent Clenchy, tell us a little bit more about their perception of what's happening there at the middle school that could be creating an environment for this kind of bullying to be happening.
Well, you know, they were a little evasive about that, they say that they've put in place after these incidents, which occurred last year, After these incidents, they say they've put in place protocols that they say have cut down on reported bullying in the school in the current school year. They said that they're working to really not perpetuate the climate that these incidents that we report on apparently grew out of. And they say that they're investigating every report that they receive about on bullying, and that they certainly don't condone that. And they are, as I said, working to improve the culture at the school so that these issues are eliminated.
Both Superintendent Clenchey and Principal Cohen are newish to the roles, you know, since, I guess, the pandemic, essentially, or some in that time period. And they kind of point to the pandemic as having an influence on behavior.
Yeah, we've all heard about, you know, how students have, especially younger students who are younger at the time of the pandemic, have had a hard time adjusting to the school, you know, on-site school and things like that. And the administrators do mention that they feel that that was a factor in these cases. But I think, you know, from the details that Ryan came up with, you know, that seems to be a kind of a pat response, mm-hmm. a formulaic response to these things. And you know, I think Ryan's reporting really shows that there needs to be a bit more engagement by the administration in some of these issues. There's a whole sidebar here about conflicts between Mr. Cohen and some educators that resulted in what one educator claims was his firing. The school is saying that it was a matter of elimination of the position because of budget issues. But these are all sort of tied up in the bullying situation, because these are the teachers who were seeing this firsthand and who were reporting these things to the administration.
And interesting that the Cape's district attorney has said publicly that he believes there's a disproportionate amount of hate incidents in our schools across the districts.
Yeah, the Rob Galbois was adamant about that, and he's made it an issue for his office to address these things. And we also talked to the Barnstable County Human Rights Advisory Commission coordinator, who said that they have also received many reports about bullying in school, harassment, cyberbullying, things like that. And she thinks that they have increased in incidents in recent years.
It is quite a detailed bit of reporting from Ryan Bray in the Cape Cod Chronicle. People can find that online. That's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. This year, Cape Cod has seen a resurgence of whooping cough, also known as pertussis. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent joins us to explain what we know about this. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
You report on the data that goes from June to mid-December, and during that time, there were 28 cases of this reported. While that might not seem like a big number, 28, it's quite notable compared to what the number has been.
Right. There were zero cases of pertussis on Cape Cod for all of 2020 through 2023, really into June of 24. So that 28 does represent what we would consider something like an outbreak. It has precedence. Back in 2014, there were 42 cases. So this has happened before, but it definitely hasn't happened for a while. So epidemiologists want the public to know that pertussis is circulating, that it sort of looks like just a regular cold during its most contagious phase, and it's something people need to know exists.
Well, let me ask you to describe pertussis and what it does to people and why there are concerns around it.
Of course. So it begins with a fairly common cold, sniffles, runny nose, some coughing, nothing particularly noteworthy for about 2 weeks, and then it gets very serious. It's a bacterial infection of the lungs. And the sort of spasmodic coughing spells are so intense, you have these really sharp inhalations in between, which are the whoops. And then they can be so intense that people vomit, they turn blue in the face or red in the face. I mean, people are rushing to the doctor at this point. They know something's wrong. But the contagious period has been before that. So it's circulating while it just seems like a runny nose. You're testing COVID negative, probably isn't anything. And it turns out this highly contagious illness has been circulating to people you know.
Mm. And infants, younger children are particularly susceptible here.
Yes. Because of how their lungs and their physiology work, they don't really have the capacity to clear their lungs of fluid the way we do with sniffling and coughing and all these things. So their breathing can become labored. Even in the hospital, they can develop pneumonia. And infants are the primary population that die from whooping cough. So it's very serious for them. And the aim of public health is to keep this disease from reaching infants in the first place because it is so hard to protect them once they have it.
You're reporting here about the Cape's uptick in this number, but it's also a larger regional issue what they're seeing. Is that right?
Yes, this is happening across New England, so it's not just a Cape Cod issue. Cases were very low coming out of the pandemic. Those protective measures that were taken during 2020 knocked the circulation of this bacterium really, really low, and it's taken a long time to rebound. So in the whole state of Massachusetts, there were only 14 cases of whooping cough in all of 2023. And then there were 840 cases last year. So there's been this really big rebound. It's similar in Connecticut and Rhode Island, Vermont. It's happening across America, but because New England's case numbers were exceptionally low, the rebound has been pretty sharp.
Just talk for a moment about the public health effort to push back on this.
Well, one, of course, is vaccination. The Tdap and Dtap vaccines are required to enter childcare. They're required to enter grade school. A booster is required in seventh grade. But there's also sort of new messaging saying not only should pregnant women get the vaccine to pass some immunity on to their the baby they're about to deliver, but also the family members of infants, older siblings, fathers, anyone else who lives in the household, grandparents, aunts and uncles, people who are going to see the baby often, should be getting or at least considering an adult booster, which is, it can come along with your tetanus vaccine. They're bundled together, diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis is what DTaP is. And getting those boosters for adults can help protect the infants that are joining their family.
Mm. And a sense of what the vaccination levels are in the schools across the Cape? Or in the, I guess you looked at the outer Cape?
Across the Cape, really. There's a lot of variation from school to school, and to some extent from year to year, as students cycle in and out of these grades. The state keeps track of kindergarten, seventh grade, and 12th grade. And in the middle schools, for instance, there's a really wide range from Nauset Regional Middle School with only 81% of seventh graders vaccinated with their most current Tdap vaccine to Monomoy Regional High School where it's 97%. Mm. So the demographics in between those two schools are not that different, but the vaccination rates are pretty significantly different. It tends to get better by the 12th grade, but in the middle schools, you do see a lot of variation across the Cape.
That is Paul Benson reporting for the Provincetown Independent, where you can find the story. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Nantucket's African Meeting House celebrated the 200th anniversary of its founding this past weekend. It's an amazing milestone and legacy. Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current has the story and more. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
Tell us about the Meeting House, which is a church, and about what the community did to celebrate here.
Yeah, the African Meeting House, as you mentioned, is celebrating its 200th anniversary. You know, it looks a lot like many of the houses on Nantucket, gray shingles, modest post and beam building. But sort of behind that facade is a ton of history. It's a National Historic Landmark, the only public building constructed and occupied by African Americans in the 19th century on Nantucket that survived to this day on Nantucket. So last weekend was a celebration of that history, bringing together folks from the Museum of African American History, which owns properties in Boston, as well as the African Meeting House here on Nantucket, and community members to sing and pray and listen to some of the history of this building and what it served, who it served, It was really the anchor of a small community on Nantucket in the 19th century called New Guinea, where black residents of the island were living and congregated. So this building, while it started as a school, it was a place for so many different things, from, you know, meetings, weddings, baptisms, just a place for people to congregate. Many sort of historical figures came and spoke there, abolitionists like Frederick Douglass, William Lloyd Garrison, Lucretia Mott. So all of that history was talked about. A local historian, Barbara White, gave a really good synopsis, and it was just a really great day to think about that history, what the building meant and means today, and also what the plans are for the future.
Jason, you have an article in the paper this week. The headline is, "Does Nantucket Really Have 10,000 Deer?" I'm so glad you wrote this because I've seen this number cited, 10,000 deer on Nantucket, and I've always wondered about it. You took a look. What did you find out?
Yeah, this is a number that's a sort of recent number that the state biologist, the state deer and moose biologist Martin Feehan is saying is actually the floor for Nantucket's deer population, which would be a huge number for such a small, sort of isolated geographic area, a really steep increase from previous estimates. But Feehan told us that, you know, he's looking at a number of different factors in coming to that population estimate. What we look at in terms of, you know, what the hunting numbers show us. We have had consecutive record-breaking seasons for the deer hunt on the island, as well as incidents of, he's looking at, car accidents, unreported deer, that are hunted. So that's a huge number. Previous estimates pegged it at, maybe 2,500 to 4,000, the state had come up with recently, maybe 5,000 to 7,000. But what, they want to talk about is managing that population. And so they are looking at doing a new extended deer hunt on Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard for the month of January, which would be an extension of what currently exists. So they're going to be hosting a pair of public hearings coming up on the 23rd to talk to residents about that potential management tool for the population.
About how many per square mile does that work out to?
So he thinks that the deer, in areas that are open to hunting is between 70 to 100 deer per square mile.
And then
the areas that are do not allow hunting are even higher than that. He thinks that this deer population has really exploded in recent years, and some of the statistics and some of the hard data that we have sort of bear that out in terms of deer harvest going up every year, being a record breaking. Some of our local officials are a little skeptical of that number, although they acknowledge that the population has increased significantly. So I think something that they're going to be monitoring and something that we're going to be talking about when the extended hunt comes up. We did try it 20 years ago within a February deer hunt on Nantucket when we were the only show, place in the state where you could hunt. People came from the mainland. And it actually ended in a ton of controversy and was canceled just because so many people came. People were hunting near houses on private property, and there was a large outcry from the community. So we'll see if it's different this time around.
Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current, where you can read both those stories. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Many commercial fishermen are antagonistic toward offshore wind, with concerns about spoiling fishing grounds, safety, ocean industrialization. Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light joins us to talk about some fishermen who are working with or for offshore wind. Hi, Anastasia.
Good morning, Steve.
I would say a sense of uneasiness pervades a lot of the descriptions here of fishermen who are working with offshore wind companies. Tell us about some of the work that they've been hired to do and why they're working with the offshore wind companies.
Yeah, so Vineyard Wind has been under construction for at least 2 years now. It started with cable laying to the mainland to bring power, and then you had the offshore installation of the turbines and foundations. And so vessels, including fishing vessels, can help out pre-construction by gathering data, deploying buoys. They can sit around as safety vessels, security vessels, just sort of monitoring the area, making sure other vessels or fishing gear isn't nearby that could be damaged, and maybe spending 24 hours out there a day just sitting at the site or, you know, dotting around. If you look at marine tracking sites, you can see a bunch of fishing vessels just moving in and around the wind farm, but just basically doing safety and security work to make sure that construction, you know, is getting underway uninterrupted and maintaining safety for all vessels out there.
Mm. You talked to a number of fishermen for this story, and I think all of them probably told you that they would prefer to be fishing, but there's very limited windows for fishermen to go out. Even working in the profitable scallop industry, there's not that many fishing days that they have. So this really can be, it's not the only thing they're doing, but it's a bridge for some of them, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, scallop vessels, it's pretty well known that they don't spend many days out fishing. Days at sea have gone down over the years. And so, you know, a vessel might just be sitting at the dock for, you know, 3/4 of the year, which is a lot. And so this is an opportunity. And as you know, there are other things they do, research work with local institutions and universities, but it's a way to get their vessel out there moving. It's not anything compared to what they'd make fishing, but, you know, it's something. Yep.
And they do seem to have complicated feelings about this. A lot of them who are do this work to keep their crews busy and their boats busy don't necessarily buy into the picture of offshore wind as it's being presented by the companies, but they are able to sort of come to a working arrangement here. And the offshore wind industry itself seems, at least the Vineyard Wind folks there in New Bedford, seem quite committed to working with the local fishing industry.
Yeah, so I mean, I think what captures this sentiment, these complicated feelings, is some fishermen didn't get back to me at all. Others would only speak to me if they wouldn't be named. You know, they didn't want their name out there associated with wind, even though their vessels are working and helping with the projects. And for those that did speak openly, we have a fishing vessel owner, Tony Alvarez. He's quite a character, but, you know, he used some colorful language to really capture this. He said it pretty plainly, "I don't have to like you to take your money," and talked about being called a traitor by other guys out on the water. But, you know, it's something where it helps economically. They're business people at the end of the day. But still, they also openly, they'll criticize, they're critical of the federal government and how they've leased these wind farms. And it's something that, you know, the manager of this wind and fisheries program, Krista Bank, is very aware of. And, you know, they have pretty open communications about it and want to make sure everyone's on the same page and that, you know, fishermen's concerns are heard. And at the end of the day, just because they accept money from offshore wind doesn't mean they're going to stop, you know, criticizing or airing concerns about it.
We have a little less than a minute here, but I want to ask you about South Coast Wind, which is kind of the next big project to come up along the line after Vineyard Wind finishes construction. Are they also committed to this, does it seem like, to working with the local fishing community?
So I wouldn't say it's set in stone yet. That seems that there are early stages of talking, but it sounds like they want to try and adopt a similar model that Vineyard Wind has created, which is doing this direct contracting. There's going to be no middleman. It's, you know, you have fisheries managers, and their fisheries manager at South Coast Wind has a background. He worked for the Fisheries Management Council. And so it would be working directly with the fishermen and trying to you know, mirror the model that has been pretty successful for Vineyard Wind, according to the fishermen themselves. So time will tell. South Coast Wind isn't set to come to the Marine Commerce Terminal until 2029, which means construction and all that, you know, safety work probably won't start for, you know, a few years now. But they've got time to sort it out, but it seems they're heading that way.
It's Anastasia Lennon, where you can read her reporting in the New Bedford Light with lots of great photos to go along with that. Anastasia, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good one.
It's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Eve Zuckoff and Jeanette Barnes. We spoke with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current and Anastasia Lennon there from the New Bedford Light. Big thanks to Dan Treadle for engineering the program. Lucky for us, he can operate under any weather conditions. He's got antifreeze in his veins. That's all we've got in Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.